This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Mark Haney. Do you hold unconscious attitudes and stereotypes that influence your actions? That's what the Harvard Implicit Association Test is meant to reveal. Today we examine the test, and we'll also discuss an exhibit at the National Underground Railroad Freedom Center meant to make visitors aware of implicit bias. Joining us now, Ryan Wynette, manager of Open Your Mind, Understanding Implicit Bias, and Ellie Reeser, vice chair of the Diversity and Housing Initiative Committee for the Cincinnati Area Board of Realtors. Did I say that right, Ellie?
It's Reiser. The German way.
Okay, the German way. I get it both ways when I see people with that last name. But if you have any questions at this point, specifically about the Freedom Center exhibit, give us a call at 513-419-7100. You can email talk@wvxu.org, or you can find us on Facebook or Twitter. And if you have any questions about the implicit association test, please hold those until later in the show. And if you'd like to take the test in the meantime and let us know what you think about it, we have a link to the test at wvxu.org. And Ellie and Ryan, thank you so much for joining us this afternoon.
Thank you.
So, Ryan, talk about what's the aim of this exhibit? Why did the Freedom Center want to have this exhibit on a permanent basis?
Well, the Freedom Center has always been in the business of trying to confront discrimination. And until recently, if you're in the business of trying to fight discrimination, you've been able to do so only at an above-the-surface view. Over the last few decades, we've learned things from the cognitive sciences that shows us that what is going on beneath the surface, outside of conscious awareness, might end up be driving problems in society to a degree much deeper than we thought even 10 or 15 years ago. And so the Freedom Center, as a museum of conscience and as a leader in the areas of diversity and inclusion, equality, the Freedom Center has a responsibility to fight discrimination with the best known methods and practices, which now includes what we're talking about today, unconscious bias, the idea that not all discrimination is limited to bad people doing bad things. Everybody discriminates.
You know, bias has such negative connotations. But what, the purpose of this, I suppose, it's not really to make people feel guilty, is it?
It is absolutely not at all. The goal of this exhibit, my guiding vision all along, has been the magic school bus visits the unconscious mind. That's what I wanted this to be about. Implicit bias as a concept lives in the part of your brain that is deemed unconscious. And despite what we think consciously, we tend to think that we run the show. But about 95% of all the mental activity, all the cognition that goes on in your head every second, every hour, every day of your life is outside of conscious awareness. Because if you had to sit here and tell yourself to breathe 20,000 times a day and to make 500 billion connections every second, you go out of your mind. So the way we do this dizzying array of things without even thinking about it is without even thinking about it. And the brain does an incredible job navigating a very complex world efficiently and effectively most of the time. But just like the most advanced computer system, it doesn't always get it right. There's some kinks in the system. And so I tell people every day that they should really feel no worse about implicit bias than they do as the 1 in 3 people that try to walk out of the exhibit by yanking on the push door, right? And and everybody laughs at that.
You get that kind of reaction.
Because why do people automatically yank a door with a handle, even when it says push? Because the vast majority of the time, doors with handles open in. They pull, right? And this is how the brain works. Close enough is good enough almost all the time, but it can be completely wrong.
So there's a lesson even in the door.
I keep them closed for that reason. It's very dramatic.
Ellie, how did you get involved in this?
Well, as the vice chair of the diversity committee for the Cincinnati Area Board of Realtors, I was reading an article in a Saturday morning in a February Cincinnati Inquirer article talking about the implicit bias lab. And the bells sort of went off thinking this is something that we as realtors in our committee really needs to look into. We contacted Ryan and met with him, a small group of us, and with his guidance, put together what I like to call a fair housing class on steroids at the Freedom Center in April, which is Fair Housing Month. It was an incredible, incredible program with 100 of our agents who were extremely enthusiastic about it. And, you know, I think certainly beyond that, the exposure to the Freedom Center and the wonderful treasure that it is, all of us were given the opportunity to tour as well just became something that I know we will want to repeat over and over again.
Yeah, and give me some more of your impressions of the exhibit when you went through it.
Well, just to piggyback on that a little bit, and Ryan knows this, I took my husband to the Freedom Center on July 4th, and he had never been there before. And not only the Mandela exhibit and the Rosa Parks exhibit, but just going through all of the things that are there, history, understanding even locally how we fit into the Underground Railroad Freedom Center. However, we ended up at the Implicit Bias Lab. And my husband was so enthusiastic that he can't wait to get back and do some of the tests. And he was kind of a skeptic about even wanting to go. So there are many far-reaching things. And I think once you go through some programs like that, it affects your entire life. Because every time you read an article in the paper or you see something on TV, it's bias, bias, bias. Implicit bias seems to be a really hot topic mm-hmm. right now. And I see it everywhere.
Yeah, Ryan, what kind of reactions have you gotten from visitors?
I mean, I would say a wide variety. Not too many on the negative end of the spectrum, but I mean, all sorts. Just to be candid, I'll tell you, because we get a lot of African Americans, a lot of people of color at the Freedom Center, and I would say in the 6 months that we've had this dedicated space, which used to, if anybody's familiar with the first floor of the Freedom Center, this used to be the gift shop, so it's now a permanent installation on the first floor. A lot of people are not surprised by this stuff, that a lot of black people, a lot of people of color have been telling me that they're just happy that science is now putting some muscle behind something that they've known quite well is been around for a long time. And but what I've been surprised by is the level of awareness within minority communities in particular of the idea that that just because you're black or because you're a woman or because you're gay, you can harbor implicit associations, implicit biases against these things if you are these things, right? Which is kind of a difficult thing to grasp.
That's interesting because I've noticed several people say on the test it's labeled as thin versus fat. Some people who take that who are on the heavy side say they end up being biased against someone who's overweight, which is kind of interesting. They come out favoring someone who's thin. So that's a good point.
You can think of it as, these biases, these associations, they often line up with our explicit beliefs. But these tests and these types of things are most interesting when they truly reveal something that you didn't suspect was there.
Right, where you say you're surprised by it.
Genuinely surprised. Yeah, not just out loud surprised in polite company, genuinely surprised. And so I'll give you just one example that's recurred multiple times and has been no less profound each and every time. As Dr. Lai later will talk about these tests, I'll just say that they operate by having people associate things with other things, right? And very, very quickly. And there are four categories on each of these tests. And so for the race test, you've got black faces, white faces, good things, bad things. And the black and the white people's faces, they're rendered in kind of like a half tone, kind of mm-hmm. like the Wall Street Journal. Mm-hmm. And they are in every way equally representative faces, right? About a dozen times over the last year, in the early version we had on the third floor and now the permanent version, people would come up to me after taking the race test and they would say, hey, listen, I know this is about science. I know this is for research. And I just took that race test with the black and white faces. I said, yeah. And they'd say, I just want to point out that the black people's faces are far more threatening in their appearance than the white people's faces. And I just wanted you to point this out so you can tell the scientists and alert them and correct it. And I would very delicately say, prepare yourself. That's implicit bias. These faces are in every way equally whatever, happy, sad. They are the same. If the black faces are far more threatening, that's not the faces. That's how you view the faces. And every time, this was a profound moment in these people's lives. They went out of their way to come point something out that they thought was in the wrong, that they thought they could point this out and make things better. And, you know, maybe they did in the sense that each and every time, I think it was the first time that they truly understood what this concept is in that very second.
Ryan, do you find that this is even people who might be strangers, this is opening them up to having conversations with other people about the results of the test and how surprised or not surprised they were by it or whatever the case might be?
Absolutely. I think it gives people our lab is in a very comfortable place on the first floor that is conducive to people opening up and to staying a while and to talking. And, you know, no meaningful conversation can happen after 45 seconds, but you get people talking for 4 or 5 minutes and exactly what you just described is happening every day. These types of conversations are happening in here. They're happening from people all across the country that don't know each other. And it's, I think, leading to I don't know if it's leading to change yet, but it's definitely leading to more people realizing that to continue to think of discrimination as only being bad people doing bad things is an incomplete understanding of discrimination.
Yeah. Ellie, how do you see this being useful in the business world?
Well, very much so. As realtors, we are bound by fair housing laws and certainly own moral codes of conduct. And we are constantly looking at and evaluating how we can help our agents become more effective. For instance, I had a diversity meeting yesterday, and we talked about discrimination that realtors are having. Someone might call them on a property, and because of their voice tones or inflections, may pick up that they're from another country or speak another language or have, you know, sort of an African-American accent, and maybe not call them back and not want to work with them. Or they treat them differentially from their other clients. We're always looking at that. So how can we help our realtors become the best professionals that they can be and be aware of how they need to conduct their business carefully?
Mm-hmm. Ryan, are we seeing a lot of businesses start using the implicit association test and then...
Yes, I think. When we first started to commit to this idea almost 3 years ago, I set up 100 Google alerts for all different manner of letting me know when businesses were going to at least publicly get involved in this. And over the course of the last 3 years, it went from 30 out of the Fortune 500 to I'm aware of at least 350 now that are have public programs that are doing this stuff. Just here locally, and we know we have an incredibly strong business culture here, many, many businesses are contacting us. And not just businesses, other organizations, schools, police departments, law firms, pretty much anybody that's got groups of people, we want to talk to them. And so I think the reason that businesses are so engaged in this, and it's piggybacking off what Ellie said, is that, yes, there is a strong feeling that this is morally and ethically the right thing to do, but there's also a growing body of evidence that says this is also better for business. This is
Absolutely.
Also better for your bottom line. And in theory, you should not have to drag a company kicking and screaming into what is in their best interest in the bottom line. Right? So that's what we're on the exciting cusp of doing right now.
We will continue our conversation, and you can join us at 513-419-7100. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Mark Haney. Joining us to discuss the Freedom Center's exhibit, Open Your Mind, Understanding Implicit Bias, exhibit manager Ryan Wynette, and Ellie Reiser, who is the vice chair of the Diversity and Housing Initiative for the Cincinnati Area Board of Realtors. If you have any questions about the exhibit, give us a call at 513-419-7100. And if you have questions about the implicit association test, hold off on those until the next part of the show. So anyhow, I heard Ellie use this word. I've heard you use it several times. It's a lab. Mm-hmm. I keep calling it an exhibit, but this is more than just an exhibit. It's a lab. So what's in this, Ryan?
So we do have some – when you walk in, you'll see four iPads with featuring some of these tests that we'll be talking about a little in a bit. But around the corner is what we really do a lot of, which is trying to talk about the science of the brain, to highlight how the brain is the most complicated thing that – we've ever discovered, hands down. But we know less about how it operates than the bottom of the ocean and outer space. It just works. And so a big part of being able to understand implicit bias, and if anybody out there has difficulty understanding what we're talking about with implicit or unconscious bias, the way I think about it personally is automatic bias, because that's what it's code for.
And
right?
It's implicit versus explicit.
Yes.
This is the stuff that's buried.
Or conscious. And the reason it's people call it either unconscious or implicit, it's used interchangeably, generally depends, and maybe Calvin will agree with me or not, where the person is coming from within academia, right? So, but some of the things that we do, since we have so many kids, so something this year, maybe 50,000 school-age kids will go through the Freedom Center. And while I can't talk to all of them, I want to talk to all of them. And so when I have groups of them in there, I very immediately introduce them to the power of the unconscious brain. And I'll always have kids that are skeptical that the unconscious brain is in any way a part of their life and it doesn't apply to them. And so I say, really, okay, as hard as you possibly can, focus, don't think of an elephant. You know, good luck. Good luck. And I guess some people do what you do, and then I'll always have some kid 30 seconds later is like, you know, I still haven't thought of one. And I say, well, I don't believe you. And then for that kind of kid, I follow up and I do a quick math problem, which I'll do here. For the people at home that are worried about being bad at math, you especially don't need to worry about this one because, well, you'll see. So a baseball bat and a baseball cost $1.10 together. And I'm asking you, by the way, so
okay.
you have to answer immediately when I ask. Okay?
Okay.
So you got a baseball bat and a baseball. They cost $1.10 together. The bat costs $1 more than the ball. How much is the ball? Come on.
Okay. Think that fast.
Well, 10 cents probably popped into your head. That's what pops into most of your listeners' heads, whether they want to admit it or not. And 10 cents is...
I didn't want to admit it.
Yeah, well, it's the beauty of it is I'm looking at you, so I know that you thought it. 10 cents is completely wrong, right? It's 5 cents and $1.05. Because
right.
If it was 10 cents, it would be $1.10 plus 10, it's $1.20, it's no good. The point is, pretty much nobody in the world has 5 cents pop into their head. Everybody has 10 cents pop in there, maybe with the idea that, oh, this doesn't seem right, but 10 feels right. It's in the question. It seems good. And it's completely wrong, right? And this is how the brain works. And so these are a couple of the things. Obviously,
unless you're math challenged.
Well, the beauty of this is even if you're a Fields Medal winner, you're probably still going to be math challenged on this one because nobody – I mean, you know where this comes from? This comes from the opening paragraph of a guy named Daniel Kahneman, Dr. Daniel Kahneman out of Princeton. He is the only psychologist to ever win the Nobel Prize. He won it in economics in 2002, and this was in the opening paragraph of his Nobel Prize address. So I stole it from a good source.
Okay. What else?
So obviously, again, as I understand it, radio does not allow people to see into the booth. But what I am going to do is just a couple of these illusions with you and hope that they're powerful enough to get people to realize just due to your gasps. I'm showing him what is called the Rubik's shadow illusion. And what color is this right here?
I'd say it's yellow.
What color is that?
Brown,
right?
Oh my gosh! You put that card over it, and then suddenly you see both of those are brown.
Exactly, right? So they're both brown, and obviously, again, I know how unimpressive this must sound over the radio.
Well, it's the other colors that are influencing you. You're looking at that in relation to the other colors inside the shadow, and you see yellow. But when you isolate it by itself, it's brown.
Context matters.
Yeah.
That's what's important about these. Context matters. And what's great about these types of illusions is that they can be – they are immediately fascinating and profound, but they can be extended to prove other points. And so a similar one is, would you say that these two shades of gray and these two squares are more or less the same?
Yeah.
Okay. So they are the same. Tell me, what about now?
No.
So he's speechless.
Yeah. It's like, what?
It's not dead air. He's just stunned. So these.
Yeah, exactly. It's what happened? It's context.
Yes,
again.
Context again. And so this again, and the reason, well, I won't get into the specific physics
and
of
what,
it.
And what happened there was that now the squares that he showed me initially were by themselves, and now the squares are in with other squares, a checkerboard kind of pattern.
Exactly.
Yeah. And now you can see what the difference is between the two.
And it really throws into sharp relief how the brain is hardwired in ways that can make it difficult to see things that are the same and equal as the same and equal. And this obviously isn't just isolated to two things on a piece of paper in a radio studio. You can think of this as two people in a job interview. The best way to think about this is years ago, there was an orchestra that was having a really hard time hiring women at the same rate as men. They were trying out the same. They weren't hiring them the same. They brought in a cognitive scientist, and he did two things. One, he visually blinded all the people auditioning from those judging, but then he installed thick shag carpeting to deaden the footfalls of everybody walking into play. Lo and behold, you put men and women in this vacuum where only their playing ability is on display, they start hiring more women overnight. Otherwise, like you said, you put us into the context that we normally have to be viewed in, man, woman, gay, tall, straight, Muslim. We no longer literally have the ability to be the impartial, objective observer. Most of us already think we are, right? So this stuff is I like to – there's a lot of redundancy because these are big concepts. And so I try to parlay them. I try to explain them in a number of ways, hoping at least one of them hits home. And I would say so far a lot of them are hitting home.
Yeah. Any other good examples that you want to
show us? Yeah, there's actually a one that I can describe. So I'm sure everybody's familiar with the little cardboard coffee filled what would you call it? Insulators? You know, the cup holders.
Yeah.
So if you hold them up next time you go into Starbucks or anywhere, because the shape is the shame. You know what I'm saying? Does one of these look longer?
Yeah.
Which one?
The one on the bottom.
Yeah. So we're holding them up on top of each other, flush. So I'm going to swish them. What about now?
Okay, that's weird.
So I'm going to just double switch.
Yeah. You switched them, and the bottom one still appears to be longer. Okay.
Right, so, and these, of course, just like all of them,
and
are
you
the
put them together
size,
the same size.
And so the trick is you're lining up the long to the short arc, and so people think it's flush, but it's not. This illusion was taught to me, and this is what's known as just a found illusion. This was taught to me by a husband and wife team, Stephen Macnick and his wife, Susanna Condi Martinez. They're a husband and wife, a pair of visual neuroscientists that run the Scientific American Illusion of the Year contest. And they actually are the ones that did a deconstruction of the biology of that dress that broke the internet a couple years ago.
Right.
Right?
It was the dress color people were supposed to.
Exactly. Yeah. Is it this or that, or is it this or that? And it's just like everything in the exhibit. It's not this or that. It's both this and that. Right? It's not either or. Either or is a thing of the past. We start to have to think of things as both and.
Ellie, did you have a favorite one of these?
Well, I have a couple of favorites, and one that you talked about at the realtor event. Why do more people die during hurricanes that are named after women? And I have a son in Miami, Florida, so I watch the hurricane forecast a lot. Do you want to give the answer?
Yeah. So the thing is, well, the stat is that every year more people die from female named hurricanes, and the theory is that people literally do not respect female named hurricanes the same way they don't prepare the same way they do for male named storms. Talk about something, if you ask somebody, hey, would the name of this Hurricane Heather prevent you from leaving your house and preparing and blah, 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 you know, it's a category 5. You'd say, well, I pay attention to the radio, I'm watching the weather. These things must play out, right? And
right.
So,
okay.
Yeah, so the line that I actually use in the talk is, I say, this phenomenon, of course, gave rise to the popular expression, hell hath no fury like a woman's storm.
Oh. No.
Yes. People think it's going to be kind of a bad pun, then it's a really good pun.
So what's the main lesson out of all these examples? What's the main thing you're driving at that you want people to take away from them?
I'm going to take somebody else's answer for this question, which came to me last week. I had three generations of an Amish family that was on their way down from central Michigan for a family reunion to southern Indiana. I did a riddle, and there's a riddle that I can't do over the air, but I assure you it is it's based on the Cincinnati Ballet Legs poster. And if you're already intrigued, now you have to come in. But let's just say this riddle, for the non-Amish community, which is the vast majority of people that I see on a day-to-day basis, it's about 5 to 10% of people that get this riddle right. Three generations of this Amish family within 30 minutes independently got this riddle correct. And I finally said to the father, you know, Cletus, forgive me for you know, I don't want to stereotype, but you don't strike me as a professional ballet dancer. And he said, no, sir, I'm an Amish farmer. And I thought, wow, you know, how much of my life I wasted on sarcasm. But I said, you know, sir, can you tell me why you you're able to get this riddle right? And without revealing the answer, he basically said, you know, Ryan, I do counseling on the side. I've been doing it for 35 years. And because of the belief system in the Amish community, very often, if people can't see where it hurts or if it's bleeding or bruised, they're likely to attribute the cause to any number of things that I know not to be true. So he said, Ryan, what I've learned in 35 years of counseling is that very often people's first reactions are not the right answer. And so the goal of this exhibit
is the baseball bat and the baseball.
Exactly.
And the, right.
The goal is to not be able to just try to eliminate this type of bias, right? The same types of biases that we're talking about in here that are showing us some difficulty in progressing society to where we want to get it. The flip side is these things are also keeping us alive, right? I mean, like, that's the reason these automatic processes are so important. As anybody who's ever gone to sleep at night and woken up the next morning knows, you didn't tell yourself to do all of these things. Somebody is giving these orders, and that's the part of their brain that we're interested in shedding some light on, going below the surface. And yeah, like you said, showing people that these do not in any way make us bad people. These make us human beings, and that's the bottom line. And so one of the things that got me on this idea to have it at the beginning was our president at the time, Dr. Newsom, was championing this idea of inclusive freedom, more freedom for more people. And I remembered a children's book author, Vernon Howard, that from the 1940s, and he had a quote that always stuck with me. He said, "A person's freedom can be measured by the number of things they're able to walk away from." And I thought, what is a black guy, are you less able to walk away from than my preconceived notions of you? And that's kind of what got the ball rolling. And, you know, now here we are in your studio.
And we will continue our conversation about implicit bias with a look at the implicit association test. You can join us 513-419-7100. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Mark Caney, along with Ryan Wynette, who's manager of the Freedom Center's exhibit, Open Your Mind, Understanding Implicit Bias. Ellie Reiser, who is the vice chair of the Diversity and Housing Initiative Committee for the Cincinnati Area Board of Realtors. And from Washington University in St. Louis, Department of Psychological and Brain Sciences, Assistant Professor Dr. Calvin Lai. You can join us 513-419-7100, or you can email talk@wvxu.org. And Calvin, thank you for joining us this afternoon.
Pleasure for me to be here. Thank you.
Yeah, can you start off by explaining how does the implicit association test work? How does that actually measure implicit bias?
Yeah. IAT, people think, and
okay. See if we can get that connection any better. We have a problem connecting with Kyle, so we will come back to him in just a moment. 513-419-7100. If you'd like to join the conversation, if you have any comments or questions about the implicit association test. And again, 513-419-7100. Ryan, what are your thoughts on the test? I mean, you hear a lot of people say, what's it really measuring?
That Dr. Banaji talks about it is it's like sorting a deck of cards. Okay, each of these tests has four categories.
And Dr. Banaji was one of the originators, correct?
Yes, yeah, sir. Okay. Dr. Banaji is currently the chair of the Department of Psychology at Harvard. She's a co-inventor of the implicit association test when she was doing her PhD at Ohio State. And she talks about the test as it's like sorting a deck of cards twice. The first time I want you to sort all the black cards on the left and all the red cards on the right, and it takes you 20 seconds. Then you shuffle them up, and this time I want spades and hearts on one side, and I want diamonds and clubs on the other side, and it takes you twice as long, right? Why? The first time the colors are the same, okay? It has nothing to do with the suits. It's red, red, black, black. It's very easy for you to make that connection. The second time they're not the same, and so you have to take the entire scope of information in, and it takes you a lot longer to make these same types of decisions. Take this as an idea, and instead of suits of cards, you have black faces, white faces, good words, and bad words. What these tests have shown in the millions of people that have taken that race test since 1998 is that for the average American, more white than black, but still many, many Americans have a very easy, automatic, effortless time associating black with bad and white with good. When we have to associate black with good or white with bad, for a lot of us, it takes longer, and we're talking blinks of an eye, right? But just this extra distance that your brain has to cover ends up predicting things about your behavior that you could not predict as accurately, and that's why these tests are important.
And let's see if Calvin is back yet. Calvin, are you there? Okay, so we still haven't reconnected with Calvin. Ellie, you took the test. What did you think?
Well, I've taken, I think four tests.
Okay.
And the first one I took was the gender equality one, you know, men and women in the workplace. Mm-hmm. And came out of it feeling like, oh, I scored very well. I didn't have a lot of bias. I'm very neutral. That was a good thing. And then I learned that that's not always such a good thing, that we really have to take a look at why did I score that way. I also did the thin versus fat test and found, you know, that I had more of an affinity with thin people. And maybe that's because in my inner mind, I'd like to be thinner than what I am right now. So, and I also did I did the black-white as well. And one of the things I find about the test is that it clearly is getting into your brain and measuring that, but I found that the flashes of having to respond go so quickly that I had difficulty keeping up with it. So sometimes that was a bit of a challenge too, which is probably my brain working, saying, why are you having trouble making the answer on that one? So yeah. Learn a lot about yourself.
Yeah. Calvin, do we have you back finally?
Yeah, I'm back.
Yeah, okay. Oh, no problem. Very good. But can we actually measure what's going on at that deep a level of the mind?
Yeah, and I think we can measure it because we're not actually asking people directly because people can't report on them. We're inferring it indirectly based on what they do, kind of like when a doctor kind of hits the hammer on your knee and looks at your reflex. We're looking at how people systematically make errors or respond more quickly or slowly to stimuli to get some sense of what's going on behind the scenes.
513-419-7100 to join the conversation. Let's talk to Jenny. Hi, Jenny. Hello, Jenny. Yeah, we seem to be having problems with the phones. We'll see if we can get Jenny back there in just a moment. You know, one of the criticisms of the test has come from a University of Connecticut professor, Hart Blanton, who says, you know, how can a test predict behavior if it can't even predict itself? Sometimes you get cases where you take the test, you get different results the second time around. I think that's what he's referring to in this instance. And he also says it's a lot of noise without really knowing what the signals mean. What do you think about that, Calvin? Do you agree with his assessment of the test?
I agree with him in the sense that as a measure, the IAT is not that reliable. Like, it's not quite the same as when I ask you what your opinion about Coke or Pepsi is one day and then asking you again the next day. Instead, the reliability is actually pretty close to what we see from blood pressure, where if you take a blood pressure test at the doctor and you get maybe a high or low measurement one day, that's not the end of the world. It's not something that kind of is stable over time. It kind of fluctuates. And in a similar way, it seems that performance on the IAT fluctuates much in the way that blood pressure does. Mm-hmm.
And let's see if we can go to Jenny now. Hi, Jenny. Are you there?
Yes, I'm here.
Okay, good. Yes, I can now. Go ahead with your question.
So my question is, I started taking the IAT back in the late 90s as part of a graduate school class, and just took it very coincidentally today for a project that we're doing. And my implicit bias scores haven't changed, despite my trying really hard to change them. This was a very moving experience for me to find out that I was leaning European American or European, and it was something I really wanted to change. So how do I change my implicit bias?
Can that even occur, Calvin? Can you do that since it's so unconscious anyhow?
Yeah, so that's actually where I've spent most of my research trying to figure out. And it seems that trying to change implicit bias is really, really hard to do intentionally, because these biases are formed over a lifetime of experience. So just 5 minutes or maybe even an hour is kind of a drop in the bucket when you think about all the experiences that you've had over a lifetime. It seems that when you have kind of long-term chronic experiences, so for example, if you have a science teacher of another race or a female math instructor, those things kind of move the needle a little bit on these implicit biases. But there isn't an easy intentional way to kind of go about changing them. So a lot of times I think it's actually better to think about how we can kind of work around them. Like, I cannot expect to change my attitudes to a chocolate bar, but I can change other things like that. I don't buy chocolate bars and I can stick to my diet.
Yeah, I was just it's interesting because and how you doing, Calvin? It's good to talk to you again. One of the we do a couple riddles in the lab, and the one that many of your audience will be familiar with is the following. This has been around for 50 years. A boy and his dad are in a bad car accident. They are taken to different hospitals. As the boy is wheeled into surgery, the surgeon walks out and says, "I can't operate on this boy. He's my son. How is this possible?" Now, do you know the classic, or do you know the answer?
Yeah.
Okay. So for the people in the audience,
do we want to keep this a secret?
Well, we'll give it 2 more seconds because there's a broader point. But so the classic answer is the surgeon is who?
It's his mother.
Right? So that's what's been around for 40, 45 years. And I think it's around less than 10% of people historically get that right. Over the last 5 years, and personally over the last 2, I can vouch for personally, is that a full 25% of kids under the age 18 respond to that riddle, gay other surgeon dad. And that is not an answer. I'm 32. That's not an answer that gets brought up my senior year of high school. Not because we weren't okay with it. It just wasn't there. It wasn't culturally available in the way that it is now after a decade of incredibly strong moves in acceptance of gay rights and homosexuality in this country. And it's neat in one way, but I'll tell you, I've been saying that a couple times when a female doctor has turned the corner in the lab and overheard it and become livid, because there are many, many more times more female surgeons than there are gay male surgeons, yet people are 5 times more likely to say gay other dad than they are mom. So it's the bias remains heavily male. But I'll tell you, that's a remarkable change in a short amount of time. And that's just something that I see every day.
Calvin, we asked people to take the implicit association test and then let us know what they thought of it. I have some comments from folks who sent us messages on Facebook. And one of the comments is from Jason, who says the test is skewed. The human brain is designed to develop patterns. It's easy to see how mistakes are made when choosing the answer, since it must be done at a fast rate. And Jason says if you take the test slowly, you show no bias whatsoever. Is he onto something? Is there a way to, I guess the word would be to thwart the test and get around it?
Yeah, so one of the early worries in terms of development of the test was things like whether or not responding slowly on average or responding quickly on average whether that would affect what you show on the test. And due to the kind of scoring algorithm that we use, that is generally unrelated to how you actually do on the test. We've looked at a bunch of little kind of things that we can do to kind of test the validity of it and make sure that some of these nuisance factors don't influence it.
Mm-hmm. What is the value of these tests?
One of the things that I think that it has been incredibly useful for is simply as an education tool, right? It's easy or hard to accept in the abstract that we might be vulnerable to bias, that something could be influencing us without us consciously knowing it. What's powerful about the IAT as an education tool is that it can show you up front that these things are influencing despite your best intentions otherwise.
Eric called. He wanted to know, is this test being used in police training and in corporate hiring processes?
The question is it being used?
Yes, is it being used in police training and corporate hiring processes?
Yeah, it is often being used as an education tool. I've heard rumblings about certain places that might be trying to use it as a diagnostic tool, like perhaps even in hiring. And that's something that we don't advise doing, particularly because it's so unreliable, right? It's on the kind of level of reliability as blood pressure. You shouldn't take one assessment to be the end-all, be-all.
Another comment we got, too, Calvin, was from Victoria, who said, I took the young versus old, and I think that the order that they asked the questions in biased the data. What do you think of that?
Yeah, so one of the other early kind of nuisance factors we were worried about is whether the order in which you took the test mattered. Like, if you had to pair white and good first compared to if you had to pair black and good first. So what we do on every test that we run online is we randomize it. So half of the people who take the test get one order and half of the people get the other order. And what we find from that random assignment is that the order in which you take the IAT explains about 3% of the variation in scores. And because we randomly assign people to it, we can control for it when we are doing our statistical analysis.
What's interesting about what Calvin was just saying is that in the year and a half that I've been in rooms in the Freedom Center where people have taken these tests and then have questions, I would say probably 100 times people have come up to me and said, "Well, how do you expect me to do? You're starting me off with black bad. You're priming me to do this. You're setting me up for failure." Not a single person ever pointed this out when they would get white good for right. They would never think the same way, and so it's this stuff just it plays out everywhere, and so it's kind of wild.
Calvin, what's the research show as far as if implicit bias is actually linked to explicit behavior? Is there a connection between the two things?
Yeah, it seems to be a weak to moderate predictor of behavior, and it varies a lot based on the type of things that are being studied. So it seems that the IAT, in particular, is pretty good at predicting things like who someone might vote for when choosing between two political candidates. And it's a weaker predictor when it comes to things that are perhaps explained by a lot of other factors that come into play. When it comes to the topic that I think a lot of people are interested in, racial bias and discrimination, it alongside kind of conventional questionnaire explicit measures tend to be kind of weaker predictors of any specific case of discrimination. And so one of the big things that we're trying to figure out as a field right now is what are the specific conditions under which we can best predict when IAT will be correlated with behavior. And we're still kind of working our way through that.
513-419-7100 to join us. Let's talk to Monica. Hi, Monica.
You didn't mean Martha, did you?
It says Monica on here.
Well,
I'm sorry. Is that
Martha.
The wrong?
Hello?
Hello. Go right ahead. I'm sorry. All right. I got
my
your name wrong?
Maybe. It's Martha.
Martha. Okay.
Yeah. My comment is about the fact that you found that 18-year-olds could see that the possibility of the surgeon was a male gay man. Do you see that much of a change in racial changing attitude under 18? Do you find them more able to identify with blacks? I myself took that and found myself slightly leaning toward the European American, which didn't really surprise me. In fact, you know, if probably maybe a more than that, but I know that I've made great attempts to be more racially open, but I just wondered about if there's a difference between response to change in race as there is in the gay lesbian community or attitudes.
Martha, thank you. We appreciate the question.
Calvin?
Yeah, I can take that. So that's one thing that we've been really interested in figuring out. Most of the time, we can't collect people that are under 18, so most of our samples are going to be kind of on the 18, 19, 20, 21 range. And we can look across the entire lifespan to see how implicit racial bias depends on when and where you grew up and how old you are. From the evidence that we have so far, surprisingly, we don't find that many differences based on the fact that you come from a particular generation or not. It seems that though that implicit biases do increase over the lifespan, but for a somewhat other depressing reason, which is that over the course of your lifespan, you're less able to control your automatic impulses. And as a result, they're more likely to express themselves on the IAT. So older folks do tend to show larger implicit biases on average across a bunch of different types of IATs, but it seems to be related to, unfortunately, cognitive decline.
Can I ask Calvin a question?
Sure.
So, Calvin, are you saying like that those older IAT takers that would probably have shown less at a younger age, just based on the like because they wouldn't have been obviously declining cognitively at a younger age?
Yeah, exactly. From what I understand, I'm not an expert in this area. The peak age was 25, so I think all of us on this radio call are past our peak, but it's a slow decline past that.
Hey, Calvin, we've got about 30 seconds left here, so summarize this for me. What in real-world application, what does all this mean?
I think that we should be cognizant, we should be aware that we have these implicit biases, and think strategically about how we can prevent ourselves from acting on them. We're not going to be aware of them in the moment, but we can think about how to design processes. So, for example, blinding the names at the top of resumes so that we don't act on our implicit biases when we don't want to act on them.
Thank you all for joining us this afternoon. Ryan Wynette, who's manager of the Freedom Center's exhibit Open Your Mind, Understanding Implicit Bias. Ellie Reiser, vice chair of the Diversity and Housing Initiative Committee for the Cincinnati Area Board of Realtors. And from Washington University in St. Louis, Department of Psychological and Brain Sciences, Assistant Professor Dr. Calvin Lai. Thanks for listening to Cincinnati Edition. You can find archives of our programs at WVXU.org. The producer for today's show was Pete Reitmeier. The assistant producer was Selena Reeder. William White composed the Cincinnati Edition theme music. Dave Shermer was the technical director. I'm Mark Haney. Stay tuned for Here and Now, coming up next on 91.7 WVXU.
By a 6-3 vote this week, Cincinnati City Council approved the expansion of Children's Hospital Medical Center in Avondale. The project was opposed by the Avondale Community Council and became a contentious political issue that involved race, poverty, and concern over gentrifying one of the city's oldest neighborhoods. Join us as we discuss the hospital expansion and other top stories during our weekly news review. That's on Cincinnati Edition, tomorrow afternoon at 1 on 91.7 WVXU.